Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM. From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to the Potterverse. It's a podcast dedicated to the book and film universe of Harry Potter. So grab your favorite wands and time turners and let's step into the night to pursue that flighty temptress adventure. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome back. My name is Mary Larson.
My name is Blake, and I apologize if my voice sounds a tad hoarse today. I feel like I'm working on something. Something's brewing here, baby. I don't know what it is, but I woke up today and I thought, man, I am miserable. I am miserable.
So many people, I feel like, have gotten little bugs, you know, this year. So if you, too, are feeling a little sick, I hope that this podcast episode will bring a little Lumos to your day. Here we go.
Yeah, well, you know, I was looking at it, Marvin. This is, we are coming down to it here, kiddo. Yeah. We got like a couple of more chapters left. And I got to tell you, the ending of this book, like the last, I don't know, five or six chapters, all phenomenal.
Agreed.
This right here, the last five or six chapters, in my eyes, makes this book worth it. And it's not just because, yay, Voldemort's back, but because what the author does in terms of her writing and how she develops Voldemort and his return and the confrontation between Harry and Voldemort and then using Cedric through that lens. Oh, man, spot on stuff. Okay. And it takes the whole Harry Potter experience, the whole lexicon, the whole universe that Harry Potter up until this point has established, and just flips it on its head.
Yeah.
And in this chapter in particular, I quite enjoyed as well. I know I said that last chapter, and I probably sound like a broken record, but this one was really spectacular as well. So that's that. That's all I got there, kiddo.
Okay. Well, everybody, this, of course, is the chapter called Priori Incantatum. And I just wanted to describe this one part that I found so fun to read. And of course, you know, Blake being someone who's just watched the movie, I just thought it was so interesting. His wand began to vibrate more powerfully than ever, and now the beam between him and Voldemort changed too. It was as though large beads of light were sliding up and down the thread connecting the wands. Harry felt his wand give a shudder under his hand as the light beads began to slide slowly and steadily his way. The direction of the beam's movement was now toward him from Voldemort, and he felt his wand shudder angrily. As the closest bead of light moved nearer to Harry's wand tip, the wood beneath his fingers grew so hot he feared it would have burst into flame. The closer that the bead moved, the harder Harry's wand vibrated. He was sure his wand would not survive contact with it. It felt as though it was about to shatter under his fingers. He concentrated every last particle of his mind upon forcing the bead back towards Voldemort, his ears full of phoenix song, his eyes furious, fixed, and slowly, very slowly, the beads quivered to a halt. And then, just as slowly, they began to move the other way. And it was Voldemort's wand that was vibrating extra hard now. Voldemort, who looked astonished, almost fearful. One of the beads of light was quivering inches from the tip of Voldemort's wand. Harry didn't understand why he was doing it, didn't know what it might achieve, but he now concentrated as he had never done in his life on forcing that bead of light right back into Voldemort's wand. And slowly, very slowly, it moved along the golden thread. It trembled for a moment, and then it connected.
Excellent stuff, Mary. Excellent. And that is a great pull from this chapter. And I'm going to tell you it's a great pull for a reason I think that you probably don't expect. Well, but we'll get into that. We'll get into that when we get into the chapter. Really good pull, though. Love it.
Thanks.
All right, ready to get in the chapter and do your mini chapter recap?
Yes,
I am. All right, let's do it.
I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good.
This chapter is of utmost significance because it is Voldemort and Harry Potter's first duel. And while their spells clash, all of Voldemort's recent victims emerge from his wand, and then Harry escapes through the portkey.
Love it. Love it. All right, Marvin. So one of the things that I really want to talk about here is, you know, we have kind of gone back and forth. And I'm just leading with the headline here, okay? I know everybody loves the fact that it's the duel between Harry and Voldemort, and Harry's mom shows up and Harry's dad shows up and, you know, Cedric, take my body back, you know, the whole thing. And while it is so tempting to focus on that and to focus on the emotionality involved with the return of these characters and how Harry finally actually gets a chance to interact with his parents in a meaningful way, for the first time ever. And it's important to recognize that. Like, wow. But I think the thing that stands out in this chapter is something that you and I have gotten back and forth about, which is Harry's exceptionalism. What makes Harry, Harry? Like, what makes him an exceptional wizard? What makes him worthy of not only the boy who lived, but also our time as readers, right? Like, why are we invested in Harry as a character? And what makes him the point of what we're reading? And I actually think it manifests itself in this chapter, particularly when Harry doesn't give in to Voldemort's imperious curse. When he, like, I love this prose that the author has here. I'll just start here. Voldemort raised his wand, and before Harry could even do anything to defend himself, before he could even move, he had been hit again by the Cruciatus curse. The pain was so intense, so all-consuming, that he no longer knew where he was. White-hot knives were piercing every inch of his skin. His head was surely going to burst with pain. He was screaming more loudly than he'd ever screamed in his life. And then it stopped. Harry rolled over and scrambled to his feet. He was shaking as uncontrollably as Wormtail had done when his hand had been cut off. He staggered sideways into the wall of the watching Death Eaters, and they pushed him away, back towards Voldemort. "A little break," said Voldemort, the slit-like nostrils dilating with excitement. "A little pause. That hurt, didn't it, Harry? You don't want me to do that again, do you?" Harry didn't answer. He was going to die like Cedric. Those pitiless red eyes were telling him so. He was going to die, and there was nothing he could do about it. But he wasn't going to play along. He wasn't going to obey Voldemort. He wasn't going to beg. "I asked you whether or not you want me to do that again," said Voldemort softly. "Answer me, Imperio!" And Harry felt, for the third time in his life, the sensation that his mind had been wiped of all thought. Ah, it was bliss not to think. It was as though he was floating, dreaming. "Just answer no. Say no. Just answer no." "I will not," said a stronger voice in the back of his head. "I won't answer. Just answer no. I won't do it. I won't say it. Just answer no. I won't." And these words burst from Harry's mouth. They echoed through the graveyard, and the dream state was lifted as suddenly as though cold water had been thrown over him. Back rushed the aches that the Cruciatus curse had left all over his body. Back rushed the realization of where he was and what he was facing. "You won't?" said Voldemort quietly, and the Death Eaters were not laughing now. "You won't say no?" Harry, obedience is a virtue I need to teach you before you die. Perhaps another little dose of pain. Voldemort raised his wand, but this time Harry was ready. With the reflexes born of his Quidditch training, he flung himself sideways, headstone of Voldemort's father, and he heard it crack as the curse missed him. I love this back and forth, Mary, because this, to me, his refusal of dominance, his insistence that he is going to do what he is going to do, his desire to stave off someone taking control of him, his determination, that to me is what makes Harry exceptional. Do you think that is a fair assessment, or do you think, like, considering what he has done eventually with the duel, and like how he's like, he focused the hardest he could.
Yeah.
Like, this is a 14-year-old kid.
Yes.
Fighting the world's most powerful wizard aside from Dumbledore. And yet he still manages to take those beads of light and push them back towards Voldemort. And that's why I said that was a really good pull, Mary, because I think it plays into what I'm saying. So I want to know your thoughts about Harry's exceptionalism being his determination.
Yes, his determination is what forces that bead to go to Voldemort. It's like, it is their will, their just mental strength. And this physically demonstrates his exceptionalism. So I agree with you. There are moments when Harry just kind of seems to roll into things out of luck or by chance, but he is an incredible athlete, as is demonstrated in this chapter, where he's able to, you know, think and react quickly. He is obviously one of the bravest, if not the bravest, Gryffindors that we get to meet in these books. I mean, here he is in a graveyard. He's just been hurt. His friend just got murdered. He's surrounded by Death Eaters. Wormtail's walking around with stub arm. And Voldemort, the scariest wizard who murdered his parents, is asking him to duel. And Harry Potter, 14 years old, will not back down, will not just take the easy way out, and is able to force with his will this amazing effect of priori incantatum, which is so, and he doesn't even know. Like, that's the coolest thing. Like, he doesn't even understand the depths of certain magic. And probably, honestly, Voldemort doesn't understand this. And so I just love it. We see passages where Voldemort is in fear, where he is astonished. So Voldemort gets surprised by this 14-year-old who is pulling magic out of nowhere, things that he doesn't even necessarily understand without doing all the research. So yes, this is a great chapter to really show his excellence.
Yeah, and when you consider the surroundings and the circumstances that are that envelop this scene, I mean, I started off with the Cruciatus curse, right? For a reason. This kid just got crucioed to the crust of the planet Earth, right? And he still finds it within himself to say no, right? Like, if that happened and he gave in, none of us would be like, oh, Harry, you suck.
No, we'd be like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This hurts so much.
Yeah, that blows. Like, and I get it. Yeah, and when I read this, and again, this, I think this is one of the things that the book does better than the movie, because I don't know how, we're so stuck in Harry's perspective in this moment that we're getting like a very ingrained experience that I don't think is capable in the film, right? Without some sort of, monologue, or without some sort of voiceover, right? This is giving us a lived experience in that point of view where we understand that the kind of determination it takes to go from getting crucioed to the center of the planet to then saying, no, I'm not going to. And then not only saying, no, I'm not going to do what you tell me, but then to physically repel the thing that Voldemort is most known for doing, Avada Kedavra, as a 14-year-old boy, is wild.
Yeah.
Wild.
The other thing that I just find so interesting when it comes to curses that Voldemort sends Harry's way is that, of course, he tries to do Imperio. You know, he's doing the Crucio, and then he does Imperio. And like you mentioned, Harry's able to fight it. And I just think it's so interesting that Harry learned to fight this from a Death Eater earlier this year.
Yeah, that is a bit of irony here that I love.
That he was taught to fight it. Because had he not been taught to fight it, Harry, as you said, he was feeling in bliss. He was in pain. Mm-hmm. It was great. He loved it. But he was drilled into trying to learn how to fight this particular course, a curse, with Foe Moody.
Yeah.
And had Harry not known that, he might have succumbed. And I just find it so ironic that a Death Eater who worked so hard to make this plan come to fruition is the reason that Harry was able to stay away from this spell.
And it's really important, I think, that, you know, this is why structure in storytelling is so important. Because you can take something that feels kind of innocuous at the beginning of a story, and then at the end of the story, recontextualize it so that you have a better understanding of the whole point.
Yeah.
And you have an introduction to something at the beginning that pays off at the end. If you didn't have that interaction with Foe Moody at the beginning, you're just like, okay, what? Like, and there's a certain mystery box involved too, right? Mm-hmm. That I think is pleasurable when you're in the middle of a story experience. But the structure of it all, it makes you recognize, and this is why I love also bookends, because bookends in circumstances like this, it makes you recognize that you're in good hands when you're watching a television show, or when you're reading a book like this, or you're experiencing a film. You realize, oh yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing I saw at the beginning, and now I understand it fully.
Yeah.
And you realize, holy smokes, there was a plan here. And the author, or the writer, or the director, or whoever that, you know, that is in control of your story, it's he or she is taking you on a path that, like, that makes sense. They're delivering it piece by piece and for a purpose. And that's why everything that you write, or everything that you direct, or everything that's put on film has to have a purpose. And if it doesn't, it doesn't belong. Okay. Right? And it's so great that we're able to pay that off in this chapter.
I agree. And this is why, of course, this is one of the most famous books, you know, the series, because this author does have these particular details. And those of us who know the future of the series were able to see so much of the payoff. Mm-hmm. And I even love the intricacies. You know, we get to hear Phoenix's song, and Harry had heard this, had heard Fox down in the Chamber of Secrets, and it gave him strength and hope. And so the people who get to hear it, it increases the courage of the pure of heart, and it strikes fear into the hearts of the impure. And so here's what we need to remember. Harry and Voldemort, using their wands, have a common core. They have a phoenix tail feather.
Yep.
It's technically Fox's phoenix tail feather.
Correct.
That they both have. So this is why this happens. Their wands don't want to fight each other. And we see this in the future. Excuse me, in the future as well. But they don't want to fight each other. Also, it's setting forth this phoenix song, because it's these phoenix tail feathers. It's not like Fox is coming in to save the day. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is phoenix tail feathers, brother feathers that do not want to fight each other, but are being forced to. And then the song is able to admit. So that song boosts Harry's courage and allows him to be fueled so he can have the will to move those power beads.
Yeah.
And this is also when we start to see Voldemort have more fear. And so the Phoenix song is helping Harry. You know, once again, it's not that Harry's bad. It's because Harry's goodness and his purity in his heart, it's giving him this extra courage. And I just thought it was so neat that
it reminds me a bit of like the blood bond and stuff that we get to see in the Fantastic Beasts, how, you know, oh, Dumbledore doesn't really get to fight Grindelwald because of this blood bond thing, and how these wands are having a somewhat similar effect. I mean, even these golden kind of waves, I picture it almost like a rainbow or like a half dome really encapsulating Harry and Voldemort. It is shielding them so that other people can't necessarily become involved. Yeah. And it's just so interesting that these wands don't want to fight each other, don't want to conflict with one another. And the way that the books are written, dueling is very different mm-hmm. than what we see in the films. When we see it here with the streams kind of catching each other, that is just for the Priori Incantatum. That is just for these dual wand course that they do this. But in the films, when we see other people duel, you see, you know, Dumbledore and Voldemort's stream of spells hit each other in that similar way. And that was just meant to be a more visual effect. Mm-hmm. But you just need to realize that this is really important, that this it's not said in this chapter, but to know, okay, there's Phoenix and then, you know, like this stuff is really put into place and it plays such a major role into Harry and Voldemort's future fighting against each other.
Right. Right. And I think there's a couple of things at play here too, Mary, when I think about it. First is the old magic. Like last chapter, we had three specific mentionings of old magic, mm-hmm. old magic that specifically Voldemort even admits to not recognizing, mm-hmm. or not even not recognizing, but just not being prepared for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and most specifically, obviously, that being the choice that Lily makes to sacrifice herself out of love for her son. And that is what, you know, that, you know, breaks open the Pandora's box, if you will, of old magic and repels the curse and thereby makes Voldemort, for the lack of a better word, disappear. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's old magic that way, but in terms of Harry's magic here, like the Priori Incantatum, you said, Mary, that Harry does this thing and he doesn't even realize that he's doing it simply by choosing to do it.
Yeah, he's just a stronger wizard at 14 years old. Right. He's a stronger wizard than Voldemort.
Well, I wouldn't say that he's a stronger wizard.
He's able to do that thing with the bead.
Right. And that is Harry's exceptionalism. So I wouldn't say that he's stronger than. I would say that he is enough to make that happen.
No, in this moment, he is stronger. Remember, Voldemort literally just came back to life.
Sure.
And he's hearing the Phoenix song, which is weakening him. So Harry's got like, it's as if they were fighting in Super Smash Brothers or something. And Voldemort only had one heart and Harry had four.
All right. Fair. And but I want to get back to the old magic thing because I think this is really important. Harry makes a choice and does what he does and proves his exceptionalism, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's by coincidence that we have mention of Lily making a choice, proving that love and sacrifice is important enough and enough of a basis towards the bias of good in the Wizarding world that it can take over the world's most powerful wizard, Dark Wizard at least, and defeat him, right? So I think there are two circumstances here where these two related people are making choices to do a thing that can stop a dark wizard, right? And that unlocks magic that they don't necessarily understand or even realize that they're doing.
Yeah. Right?
I think that's on purpose.
Yes.
And there's also some other old magic here going on too. Mary, you said it too, which is the two wands, mm-hmm. right? The two wands share the fox's tail feather. They don't want to fight each other. And even wizards, and even, what's his name? Ollivander says, we don't know why wands choose wizards. We just know that they do. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something here to be said that the wand recognizes fox's tail feather, if you will, but the wand itself specifically recognizes that as a brother wand or a cousin wand or whatever you want to Voldemort, perhaps the wand recognizes part of Voldemort in Harry as a Horcrux. And that's why it chooses Harry.
I would agree. Either it recognizes, oh, there's a piece of this guy in here. These two belong together. Or the OG prophecy that neither can live while one is alive.
Sure.
And these two need to be well matched. So I just find it so interesting, you know, as we're going through this deep dive of this read through, to be pulling from things from the past and now the future as readers who know what happens,
yeah,
to really see these bits that the author intertwines so beautifully.
Yeah. And there's also some other magic that's happening here too, Mary, that I think it may not be necessarily old magic, but it's certainly magic that neither Harry nor Voldemort are prepared for. And of course, listen, the elephant in the room is... again, for the lack of a better term, spirits of these people that Voldemort killed showing up. That let's put a pin in that for a second.
Okay,
the echoes, if
yes,
you will. Okay,
echoes.
But we're gonna have to get into a larger conversation of what they are. But let's put a pin in that for a second. What I also found spectacular in this chapter was when they're in the duel. And then all of a sudden, Harry starts to float. But it's also something that Voldemort does too. Mm-hmm. And it's at that moment, Harry recognizes Voldemort looks a little scared here.
Yes.
Because he doesn't know why it's happening,
yes,
either. That is tremendous writing. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly something that is absent from the film. And that sucks. Because there's a lot here that happens that we just don't understand. And we don't have to have the answer.
No.
We don't have to. Like, why do they float? I don't know. But they do.
It's to remove them from the Death Eaters.
Right. But whatevs. Like, that's the plot purpose of it. Like, the Golden Dome, that removes any possibility of anybody else getting involved in the fight. Awesome. Great device. But what's the point of them floating? I don't know. Magic. Freaking magic,
yes,
bro.
Yes.
Right? Why isn't that in the film? Like, it just alludes to the fact
that... I feel like that should be the tagline for the Goblet of Fire movie. I mean, because honestly, they could only do so much. And so they really had to get what they could into the movie. Because the movie itself, a lot of people love, you know? A lot,
yeah,
of people, that is their favorite movie to watch. Whereas a lot of people, this is their favorite book to read. And frequently... those are not the same.
It's funny because I think the film is a good film.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's one of the better Harry films. I would say that it's like in the top 4 or 5, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But as an adaptation of the book, and I think what the book was trying to accomplish, I would say that it is... it is probably the worst adaptation of the books. What do you think?
The best adaptation?
No,
of the
worst,
oh, the
adaptation.
Worst. I don't know. It's so hard. It's so hard because this book is giant.
Yeah.
And I feel like they had to focus on the magic of the world, and then Voldemort is back. So, and I'll come back to you after we rewatch it.
Yeah.
Because it's not that I would say it's my least favorite of the movies. I don't know. I have to. Great question, Blake. Great question. So you want to talk about the echoes?
Yeah. But let me just read this little portion here because I love this portion. And then nothing could have prepared Harry for this. He felt his feet lift from the ground. He and Voldemort were both being raised into the air, their wands still connected by that thread of shimmering golden light. They were gliding away from the tombstone of Voldemort's father and then came to rest on a patch of ground that was clear and free of graves. The Death Eaters were shouting. They were asking Voldemort for instructions. They were closing in, reforming the circle around Harry and Voldemort, the snake slithering at their heels, some of them drawing their wands. The golden thread connecting Harry and Voldemort splintered, though the wands remained connected. 1,000 more offshoots arced over high over Harry and Voldemort, crisscrossing all around them until they were enclosed in a golden dome shaped a cage of light, beyond which the Death Eaters circled like jackals. Beyond, their cries strangely muffled now. Do nothing! Voldemort shrieked to the Death Eaters, and Harry saw his red eyes wide with astonishment at what was happening. Saw him fighting to break the thread of light still connecting his wand with Harry's. Harry held on to his wand more tightly with both hands, and the golden thread remained unbroken. Do nothing unless I command you! Voldemort shouted to the Death Eaters, and then an unearthly and beautiful sound filled the air. It was coming from every thread of the light-spun web, vibrating around Harry and Voldemort. It was the sound Harry recognized, though he had heard it only once before in his life. Phoenix Song. I love this because, let's just say for the sake of argument, right, that, I don't know, like, let's just say that Harry and Voldemort shared a dragon heartstring core, yeah, right? Would Harry be hearing a dragon?
Probably.
Right?
If the dragon song, you know, did that kind of thing.
Right. Like, I don't know.
But I think so. I think so. I think that the song is because of the chorus, not necessarily just because he's a Gryffindor. Now, he's hearing it in a courageous way, whereas a person like Voldemort would hear a Phoenix song as a terrifying way. Just like, think about when Fox came in and attacked the basilisk.
Yep.
That music made Harry feel good, but probably scared the basilisk.
Sure.
So
there's a lot to wand lore here that we just don't know.
Right.
And the mystery of the Phoenix song and them floating above everything and they're creating this dome is a really important factor into how this whole thing transpires, which is why, Mary, I wanted to put a small pin in the echoes of these spirits, if you will, and why I think that was a natural lead into that conversation.
Yeah.
So, Mary, tell me what you think is happening.
Well, this spell is part of the reverse spell. So you can take, like we saw some of this when you know, when we had the wand at the beginning of the book, and then you can figure out what the previous spell was when we had the...
Amos Diggory did it, right?
Yes.
Didn't, yeah.
So with Harry's wand,
yep,
to say like, okay, this shot up the dock mark.
Yep.
So this is a form of that. And so Dumbledore is going to say, and this is why we almost need to put a pin in this a little longer, Blake, because soon when Harry talks about this experience with Dumbledore, Dumbledore is going to talk about how these are echoes. They're not necessarily ghosts. You know, Harry, of course, has wondered and wished almost that his parents were ghosts. He got to meet ghosts in the castle wondering, okay, are my parents ghosts? And then, of course, we had the Mirror of Erised, and those two weren't actually like real life, real time his parents.
Right.
So I'm going to actually challenge us to put a pin in this just a little longer to talk with Dumbledore and to use his exact wording, because this is all still quickly in the moment. What is interesting, however, is that all of his most recent spells are being regurgitated.
Yes.
So we see the hand of Wormtail, the new hand that he created. Voldemort's wand is screaming in pain. And to me, that's the Crucio curse.
Oh, I like that.
Coming back at him.
Sure.
Not just like being afraid of this bead and the Phoenix song, but actually this is the spell being regurgitated. So
fair.
That's how we're supposed to see that. It's just spewing out like, oh, this is what I just recently did.
Sure.
Interestingly enough, there is a writer error in several copies of this story where James Potter comes out before Lily does.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So in the audiobook, I think it's fixed. In my copy here, and this might be an OG copy that I got in,
yeah, I think that's first edition, isn't it?
This probably
the one that
is.
You're using?
Yeah, let me see. Yeah, so if you have, so this one that I have here is a first edition. This is the one that I got when I went to the Midnight book release party. But Blake, you have the illustrated version, which came out, I think, just last year, The Goblet of Fire.
Yes. Let me find the excerpt here.
So it's,
and then
as everyone's
you read
coming
yours
out,
and then I'll read mine.
Oh, okay. So sure. I will pull it on out. So mine, of course, being older, let's see. And now another head was emerging from the tip of Voldemort's wand, and Harry knew when he saw it who it would be. He knew, as though he had expected it from the moment when Cedric had appeared from the wand. Knew because the man appearing was the one he'd thought of more than any other tonight.
Mm.
The smoky shadow of a tall man with untidy hair fell into the ground as Bertha had done, straightened up and looked at him.
and Harry, his arms shaking madly now, looked back into the ghostly face of his father. "Your mother's coming," he said quietly. "She wants to see you. It will be all right. Hold on."
Okay, so let me read mine.
Okay, the more updated version.
Yeah, so here's mine. And now another.
And this is wrong, just remember, friends, because if we're going backwards, Lily died last.
After James.
Yes. So, right. Yes.
So James has to appear technically before Lily does.
No.
No.
My version's wrong.
Sorry, no, I'm sorry. James has to appear after Lily does. Yes. Okay, all right, fair enough. And now another head was emerging from the tip of Voldemort's wand, and Harry knew when he saw who it would be, he knew as though he had expected it from the moment when Cedric had appeared from the wand.
So all of that is the same.
Knew because the woman appearing was the one he'd thought of more than any other tonight.
So same, except
the smoky shadow of a young woman with long hair fell to the ground as Bertha had done, straightened up and looked at him. And Harry, his arms shaking madly now, looked back into the ghostly face of his mother. Yeah. "Your father's coming," she said quietly. "He wants to see you. It will be all right. Hold on."
There you go.
So it's very similar, obviously, but different. And Mary, I think...
So who says it to him in your version? So in my version, it is James that tells Harry, "When the connection is broken, we will linger for only a few moments, but we will give you time. You must get to the portkey. It will return you to Hogwarts. Do you understand?"
Let's see. Let's see. "Looking down at him, and he spoke with the same distant echoing voice as the others, but quietly, so that Voldemort, his face now livid with fear as his victims prowled around him, could not hear." Yes, so it's James Potter.
Okay, cool. So what's interesting is that James is the one, he figures out, this echo of James, yeah. Figures out it's a portkey, tells him to hold on. James is the one that's really kind of walking Harry through how to get back and encouraging him. And I love this because through book four, we have such a wonderful feelings and memories of James Potter. We get referenced of what a great Quidditch player he was. We know him as a great friend to the Marauders. You know, we just have all these wonderful things. And it's so interesting because, of course, as we go further into the series, we get to learn that James also had faults. It's not that James was a terrible, terrible, terrible person his entire life. Otherwise, right. Lily would not have chosen him. But, you know, we hold him up on a pedestal. And I love that even in this moment. You know, we think back to just last book. Harry thought he saw his dad with a stag.
Yeah.
And yet it was Harry. So I just love that we have these moments where Harry is seeing himself as moments of his dad, is getting encouragement from his dad. So it's just very interesting because after here, it switches and we see Lily as the strong witch and yeah. as the one that really did this ultimate sacrifice and all these kind of cool things.
I think there are two things that are happening here, Mary. One is the switch of the characters. I think the switch of the characters in the order that they arrive mm-hmm. imbues far different meanings for Harry, right? Because again, when you look at this, all right, let's look at this from a macro broad point of view here. We have a group of adult men prodding, poking, bullying a 14-year-old boy led by a wizard who wants to not only kill Harry, but like take away Harry's agency, like embarrass Harry, take away his exceptionalism. Like we've determined that his exceptionalism is rooted in Harry's determination. Mm-hmm. Voldemort is doing everything he can to wipe that from existence mm-hmm. by making Harry bow, by saying, "Harry, we have rules here. I'm sure that you were taught how to duel, right?"
Yes. Professor Lockhart.
Right. Let's duel. And he's teasing and bullying this kid who doesn't really have any training in this kind of fashion.
That was it. That
right. Like it. He got it from Gilderoy Lockhart of all people. Right. Mm-hmm. So he's purposely doing that. Having said that, the other part of this is when we look at it from that perspective, the big macro view, we can then take that, and because we were so specifically in Harry's perspective, we can realize, too, that in this moment when he's being bullied and in the process of being killed, because Voldemort could have been like, okay, Avada Kedavra, dead. Let's move on. But he didn't. Harry, in this moment, all he wants is his mother. All he wants is the person that sacrificed herself for his protection, right? And that recognition, that empowerment, because it's not specifically noted in the book, probably because it was originally intended that his father was to come out before Lily. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it from that minor or that micro perspective, it changes the whole meaning.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that gives the idea that Harry's choice is informed by Lily's choice. Hmm. Though, on the other side of the coin, I love the idea that James is the one that shows up and says, your mother's coming. Your mother's coming. And it's going to be okay.
Yeah, they just didn't die in the right order.
Because that reinforces the fact that it's still Lily who's the one that serves as the ultimate protector. Like, it still serves as the person that, like, as the anchor.
Yeah. But as I said, it's interesting because if you think about this as the halfway point in the books, things switch from here on out in the books in regards to who we kind of hold up on a higher pedestal as a parent.
Sure.
So I'm okay with this.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It makes sense. So I think those are the couple of things that are happening in this moment. But I do think it's important, Mary. I know you wanted to put a pin in it, but I do think it's important to at least recognize, if we're going to use the terminology that Dumbledore uses in the next chapter, that's fine. But I think it's important to recognize the sentience of these echoes.
Yes.
Right? Because they are fully aware of what's happening.
Yes.
They are, in fact, they're interacting.
Yes.
Not only with Harry, but with themselves.
Yes.
Right? They have a sort of...
omniscient.
Well, I wouldn't say omniscient. I would say they have a physical awareness. Mm-hmm. Because, like, if you're omniscient, that means you're all-knowing, right?
Okay, sorry.
Like, that means you know everything that has happened, that's going to happen, and will happen.
Not true.
Not true. But they have a physical awareness. Even Cedric has a physical awareness, and he's such a freaking Hufflepuff when he's like, take my body back, will ya? Because he knows that's like the one bit of closure he can give his father.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I know, but I'm saying he's like such a Hufflepuff this is his one last like request as... So how can an echo of a life be a... Or how can an echo of a life have such physical awareness of their current surroundings? How is that possible?
Well, Cedric just died, so he's pretty aware of his physical surroundings. He was in the graveyard, knew Voldemort came back, knew all these things were happening. In my opinion, all these people were up in heaven, and Cedric just got there and was like, guys!
You wouldn't believe!
Avengers, assemble! I have to catch you up real quick. I feel like he died, and maybe everyone who's been dead has just been able to watch this the whole time. Like, live stream.
Yeah, I like it.
Thank you. And then they can use the echo of their visual body to communicate a bit. Not as a ghost, but like...
as a conduit.
Yeah. Okay, like here's my one phone call.
So then here's my next question. Does Avada Kedavra not only kill the person that... you know, it strikes. Does it take... an essence of that person, a small essence of that person to facilitate that conduit?
I don't know what you're getting at. Sorry.
I mean, all right, so like Voldemort kills all these people, right?
Yes.
Like, Does it like split part of their soul so that part of their soul still lives in in the wand?
I don't think so.
Then how do you explain the conduit?
I don't know, Blake.
Well, that's what I'm it's just a conversation.
I have no idea. I'm sorry. You've gone so deep that my brain hurts now.
Fair. And this is why I love this chapter, because there's just so much that we don't know and we don't understand. Yeah. That, like, it's fascinating. The wand lore alone in this chapter makes this chapter worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's gorgeous.
Yes.
This might be my favorite chapter yet.
I feel like you said that last time.
I think I did.
Awesome.
So it goes to show you how much I love the end of this book.
Yes.
Anything else that you'd like to talk about in this chapter, my darling?
Nope.
Yeah, I feel like we got it. I think we covered a lot of it. You ready for your different perspective?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Holy cricket. You're Harry Potter. I'm Hermione Granger. And you are?
Frank.
Frank!
Oh, man.
Haven't seen you in a while, bud.
I'm back.
How's it been?
Listen, once I died,
yeah,
I learned a lot. That guy was a wizard. Like a real wizard, like not in the movies.
Yeah, like a straight up real.
They've been here all this time.
He's like Gandalf.
Yeah.
But like evil Gandalf.
Yeah, this is wild. And I made friends with all these other wizards who this guy killed. We're part of a club.
Oh, yeah.
We meet every Tuesday night.
Do you do books or do you do wine tasting?
We just sit in a circle and we talk about our feelings.
Oh, okay.
And, all right. You know, somebody brings tea. Because we're all British. So.
Is it kind of like a thing like, hi, I'm Frank and I'm dead?
Yeah. How did you die? Oh, did he do this one to you? Yeah, where were you? Was there anything you wanted to do?
Yeah.
What did they do with your body? Because you know what they do with it. And so when Cedric, you know, died, we told him, buddy.
Yeah.
Buddy, your body is still there.
Go
so
get
we
it.
Gave him, yeah, because he joined the club. Yeah, as soon as it happened, he joined the club. You just bloop. It's Tuesday. I mean, thank God he died on a Tuesday.
And what would have happened if it was like Thursday? You'd have to sit around.
He probably would have forgotten about his body. So it's thanks to me.
Yeah.
Do you know how long it took somebody to find my body?
Oh.
Nobody goes in that abandoned house except the kids.
The teenagers.
Yeah.
And they're probably just like looking at it going... As a matter of fact, that was the true story behind Stand By Me. It was somebody finding your body.
Here you go. So rather than make a movie about Cedric Diggory, I told him, get your body back.
Oh,
you tell that kid. You tell that kid. I know about that kid. I heard about that kid way back when, a few months ago. Oh, you know who I can't stand though? Bertha Jorkins. Doesn't shut up.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I can only imagine.
She comes to the Tuesday night meeting, monopolizes the whole thing.
She's always complaining left and right, I bet. God. Oh, I should have done this, and I could have done that.
Why did I go to the forest? Why did I go on a date with Wormtail in the woods? I thought it was going to be romantic. Nobody's ever taken me for a romantic walk in the Albanian woods before. No one goes on a romantic walk in the Albanian woods.
Lady, you should have known right from the beginning. Gosh.
And I think she's trying to ask me to go for a walk in like Echo Farm in the Albanian
woods. Now, is this like a walk and chill type deal? Or is this like a...
I don't know. You know. Listen, there's some canon ideas. I don't know. I'm all set. I'm out. But yeah, it's pretty cool. There were wizards all this time. I didn't know. You would have thought I would have known so much after going to war.
Yeah.
After working in this weird house.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know.
Yeah, and I feel like you would have some...
Did they even find my body? I was probably eaten by that snake.
Guaranteed you were eaten by the snake. Did you watch it get eaten by the snake? That's the thing.
No.
No, okay, because you couldn't bear to look.
No, man. That's why I told Cedric, because I saw that snake down there again. But I get a body back. Who cares about your dad? End scene.
Oh, good stuff. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, I wanted to let you know that we're not doing these episodes live like we have been in the past, just because Mary's still dealing with the long COVID issues, and we can record when we can. And we don't have a set schedule, so... Just bear with us as this happens. But I wanted to remind you that you can send us your thoughts and questions and emails to maryandblakemedia@gmail.com, and we will bring them up here in the podcast. If, you know, it's not like, oh, did this person do that? And that. It's just like, what are your thoughts? Like, what are your thoughts about the wand lore? And do you have questions that arise from this episode as we're discussing it? Like, hey, did you know, because of this, why that? You know, I want to have a conversation and not just be answering questions. Or if you just want to make fun of us and have fun at it, we can do that too. So I will always be glad to make fun of myself. That's the whole point of what we're doing here. So, Marvin, anything else that you want to say before we depart the podcast?
No, that's it.
You ready to close it out?
I sure am.
Let's do it.
Thank you all so incredibly much for checking this on out and tuning in. We want to thank those of you who took the time to do a little screenshot of your podcast app and throwing it up in your stories. Don't forget to tag Mary and Blake Media as well as Mary Larson on Instagram. And
Mary _ Larson.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, find me.
Yeah.
And if I see that you're a normal person.
Yep.
I'll let you in.
And Mary's Echo will allow you to in.
Yeah. I did have to like privatize my personal account.
You're getting some creeps.
Oh my gosh. I get so many creeps. You know what it is? It's my silver hair.
Yeah.
I get silver haired men.
Yep. They got a fetish.
Oh my God. Leave me alone.
It happens.
I'm married.
Happy to a really big, strong Slytherin. So be careful. Well, everybody, go to maryandblake.com. Check out all the great podcasts and blogs that we have over there right now. Currently, actually, the only other podcast we are featuring at the moment is being featured at jointhenerdclan.com. It is Keep Calm and Crown On. We are halfway through this fifth season of The Crown, so you want to stay up to date with that.
All right. My name's Mary.
My name is Blake.
Mischief managed.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.